introduce our main speaker for this evening, Bobby from San Diego.
Bobby!
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bobby. Happy New Year, everyone. Yeah, amateur night, like was brought up earlier. You know, it's those people that are going to drink one night a year, and tonight's going to be the night. And the rest of us drank every night of the year and drove, right? So I said I'm an alcoholic, and I am. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety that's described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got this really cool email from these guys this week that just reminded everybody on the email of what the purpose is. And, you know, in accordance with the third and fifth traditions, I'll try to confine my discussion to alcoholism. And, you know, in the fifth tradition, it talks about the primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic still suffers. But if we went around this room and we asked everyone here what that message was, we'd get a lot of different answers. And that's killing us in AA. Because the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells us that there's a way out upon which we can all agree and join in brotherly and harmonious action to accomplish, the key word being action. But the way out is outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we get a lot of diluted message throughout AA from all sorts of different areas, but I'll try to confine my conversation tonight to that. I said I'm an alcoholic. I'm also an arrested alcoholic. I've been arrested many, 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 many times. And like if I had known it was a thing of social prestige in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have counted how many times I've been arrested and kept track of it. But I didn't know it was going to be so popular. I'll briefly qualify, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about my recovery. You know, I drink for effect. There's a few things in my life that pointed back way back when would have been clear to someone sitting in my seat today that there was a problem. And one of them was I was 15 years old, and I grew up here in San Diego. I grew up in Ocean Beach in the 70s. That'll explain a lot right there. But, you know, in that era, we drank. And we drank early. And we drank often. It's sort of like Chicago politics. And the thing is I passed out on someone's lawn at the top of Saratoga Avenue after a party. And, you know, I came to, it was like one of those situations where in the old days they had those really hardcore metal sprinkler systems. And it came on and woke me up. And you know, and they used to dig a ditch and put this big old metal piece there. And so I had fallen. I don't know exactly what I did, but I was there and the sprinkler was on in my face and there was a bottle of beer in that little crevice where the sprinkler is. And I remember thinking to myself that I was happy I hadn't spilt my beer. And you know, I used the beer as sort of mouthwash right there and spit the cigarette out that was in there. And, you know, I was naked. And so it was like 5:30 or 6 o'clock on a fall morning, ninth grade year, and I needed some clothes. And in the old days, we didn't have these fancy trash cans that they have today. They actually had bags. And so I dumped these people's trash out, and I took the bags, and I poked little holes in them, and I made myself a little dress. And I had a poncho with little holes in it. And I was going home. And it was about 7:30 in the morning, and all the other kids were coming to school. And honestly, no one thought that was strange. It was just Bobby, and it was just another night. And I mean, there's something wrong there. And I think there's something wrong there. And that's kind of how it was. You know, we did things that were insanely tragic, right? And, you know, being the sophisticated criminal that I was, we used to get our skateboards to go do burglaries. We got this bright idea that we would need to acquire some fluorescent light fixtures. And we felt like the underground parking garage at the Point Loma Bluffs was perfect for that. And this is another example of where the delusional thinking had already set in. And I got up on, in those days cars were steel. I got up on a steel car with no insulation, and I used my grandmother's toenail clippers with no insulation to clip the lights. And I shut the lights down in a three-story parking garage that night. And I sent myself flying onto the concrete. And I don't know anything about electricity. I got back up on the car, and I got those lights. I did not know I was not going to get shocked again because I'd already shut the power out. I didn't know that. I thought, the next clip, I'll get them. And anyway, so we're with our skateboards going down Leland Street with these 2 8-foot light bulbs between us, and it was pretty pathetic. And so these are some things that in my behavior as a young guy I could probably point to that indicated that there was going to be a problem. And it was the way I thought. Everything I thought was different than the way other people thought. I did everything to the extreme, and there was no in-between. And in between my first drink and my last drink, I spent about 15 years locked up. And I got tried as an adult early. I went to prison when I was 17 years old. I got out when I was 32. I spent long stretches, 7 years, come out for a couple of months, 4 years, come out for a couple of months, in and out on the revolving plan. And it was all directly attributable to my drinking. And I haven't had a drink in 19 years, and guess how long it's been since I've been arrested. You know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out. And, you know, in 1992, I got on the most important drink of my life. Most important drunk. I got out of, you know, I tell people I grew up in the gated communities like I was some sort of high bottom. But some of those facilities sit on some pretty prime real estate. And I got out of a facility up in Crescent City, California in 1992. And I don't know today how I acquired a half pint of Southern Comfort between Crescent City and San Francisco, but I did. And in San Francisco, the bus driver, there was only three of us on the bus. Myself, the bus driver, and some poor lady at the front. And I got thrown off the bus in San Francisco for being obnoxious. I'm not really sure how I got in an argument with anybody on that bus, but I did. And I got on the most important drunk of my life that time. And I was on a 8-month run, which was brutal. And I paroled at 195 pounds and pretty fit. And I got busted at 107 pounds and pretty sick. And in November of 1992, it was coming to an end, and I had burned out all the bridges. You know, my family had been long gone. Friends are long gone. Everything was just pretty much me, myself, and whoever I could steal from that day to get the next drink. And people would say, how much did you drink, you know, in a day, or how much did you do in a day? And I would just, whatever amount of money I had that day is how much I did. And some days it was a lot, and some days it wasn't so much. And I must have been miserable those days it wasn't so much. I mean, really miserable. And on December 1st of 1992, I used to do this routine where I'd get up about 5:30 in the morning. I'd come to about 5:30 in the morning. And at that point, the mattress was off the box spring because I would fall out of bed. And so I would come, literally roll onto the floor, and I'd crawl into the bathroom, and I would do this little thing where I would try to rinse my mouth out with a little Jack Daniels, kind of brush my teeth, rinse my mouth out all at the same time. And I'd just spit it out because there was going to be about 30 minutes of dry heaves after that. And I would go through that process every morning. yeah, what's wrong with me, right? I go through that process every morning, and this morning, you know, I'm on my knees in the bathroom, and I'm not on my knees because I'm praying, I'm puking, I'm hugging the bath, the stool, and you know, I asked for help, and that was December 1st of 1992, and I haven't had a drink since. And what happened was something came to the forefront of my thought. And, you know, I'll say a few things throughout the course of the night that firmly in my belief today are the act of God. If you're uncomfortable with that, then, you know, welcome to AA. But here's the thing. I didn't ever call the police on other people, let alone myself. And that day I called the police on myself. And I called my parole agent and asked her to come get me. And you know, honestly, that was agreeable because she'd been looking for me anyways. You know, I was one of those persons that never really reported to their parole agent because it was just easier than to go through all that bottle and pee in and stuff that's not going to be clean anyways. There was a time I had a Catholic priest giving me his urine. We won't go there. Anyway, so that got old. And so I would just never report to my parole agent. And so she was looking for me. We agreed to meet. And I had to go back and do some time. And in case you haven't guessed this, I have a big mouth. I have a really big mouth. And I have a way of, like, communicating with people. And so I would get myself, and my mouth would get myself into a lot of trouble. So when I got back to prison, I actually owed a little security housing unit time. I owed some time in the hole, which was really good for me in this case, because I've been on a lot of yards where I drank and partied just as hard as I could have, I mean, anywhere else. And so as soon as I got to Donovan, they checked me into 7 building, and as soon as I got to 7 building, they moved me up to Corcoran. And I got to Corcoran, and here's another thing that I think is just a loving and forgiving act of God. I had some assaults on some officers there several years back, and a couple of them were there that day, so it wasn't a really warm welcome. And so the thing is that you know, there's a different sense of there's a different order. Let's just say that. And they were cleaning out this area in a bedrock. They were cleaning out the cell of all reading material. And there was a softback edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in that cell. And they did not take it out. And they looked at it, and the guy said, "What's that?" He thought it was a Bible at first. And he said, "What's that? Let me have the Bible." And he said, no, it's something about drunks." And he threw it back in. And the way these cells are configured, there's a little concrete cubby hole underneath a concrete bed. And he threw it under there. And what I'm going to tell you is that's the only book I had for 4 months. And I read it. And I read it more than once. And I got introduced in a very unique way to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in a pure and unadulterated form. Because I hear people say, "Think through the drink." And I hear people say, "Take your time to take the steps." And what the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me is none of that. And if I had the power to think through the drink and just not drink, I wouldn't be here at this stupid meeting tonight. All right? I'd be out fishing somewhere just not drinking. But I've lost the power of choice and drink. And what that means, what powerlessness means to me, is I'm going to drink again. And I mean, that's powerful. I am going to drink again. And if I'm not 100% convinced, with no lurking notion or any kind of that horse pucky in my mind, I'm going to drink again. Being 99.99% convinced will get me drunk 100% of the time. And I've been 100% convinced since my first day. I am convinced. I am powerless over alcohol. I will drink again on my own power. That's the bottom line. And what I got, now I'm not going to tell you I sit here and I understood the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I didn't. But what I did is I identified, like, I'm the jaywalker. That's me. And that's me 100%. And I identified with that story in the Big Book, and I'm like, wow, holy mackerel, that's me. I mean, there's a solution for a guy like me. And so then I got another brilliant idea. After reading this book, I thought, you know, I might have alcoholism. And so what happened from there is that, I don't know, maybe there's a few of you that might actually know the situation, but when you're in Corcoran, everywhere you go is in 5-point restraints. And you don't go by yourself typically. You go with a group of other people that are just like you. They've got as big a mouth or bigger than yours. And so they put you on this long chain you all together, and I can guarantee you 100% that one of those 10 guys is going to say something that day, and everybody's going to get tackled. So for any reason to come out of that cell means you're going to fight that day. And I mean, you're going to get hit on with some billy clubs and tasers. It's a bad sign when you get used to a taser. And what I'm telling you is that I got this idea to go to the law library, which required all this rigmarole, so that I could look up the word alcoholism in the yellow pages. And I stole that page. And I stole the page for L.A., Orange, and San Diego counties. And I think I got about... So I had a little free time. And I got about 60 names of recovery homes for alcoholism. And I wrote my first wave of letters. I think I wrote 60 total. And my first wave, you know, I get stamps issued to me and a weekly stipend. And so I sent out 5 or 10 a week, whatever it was. I can't recall now. And I only got one response. And I got a response from a guy here in San Diego. And he sent me an application. And he told me, you know, and in the letter I kind of just laid it out. Like I'm full of, that I lie, that I can't even tell the difference between the truth and the false. I didn't put it in those words. But essentially what I told this guy is that I'm not even sure if I remember the story I told to cover up the truth or the truth. And so the truth from the false, right? And our book talks about that. And I'm unable to differentiate the true from the false. And the main problem with me centers in my mind. And in that letter, I said that without saying those words. And he wrote me back and he told me, write him once a week until I heard from him again. And I wrote him once a week for about 2 years, 8 months, and didn't hear from him. And then I always find myself in the little situations. So I ran the Mud Duck gambling ticket in there. And so I had lost my stamps because Syracuse did not cover the spread for me, and I did not write the letter that time. So I didn't write that letter that week, and it didn't get mailed out. And like 3 days after that, I got a letter from this guy that said, "Hey, are you still sober? I need to know you're doing the right thing." And I did not realize it at the time, but he had been reading my letters to his house meeting and using that as a tool against the guys that were complaining about this horrible place they were in. And this is a guy who wants your bed. You want to trade places with him? And so, anyways, you know, when I got out and you know, here's the thing. This is God working in my life because I'm not ready to work my own life. I can tell you that. I'm powerless, remember? So we get out in this god-awful town called Hanford, California. And it smells like cow manure, right? And there's a Greyhound bus stop, and it's like commingled with a liquor store. You know, you buy your ticket at like a Western Union thing in this place, right? It's not like an official Greyhound. It's a parking lot. And there was 6 of us that got out that morning, 5 other guys and me, and that's the perfect number for a 6-pack. And the guys that got out with me had already concocted a plan on how they're going to get that 6-pack, and we're all going to go in together. And so while they went off to get the 6-pack, I was seeing what the schedule was for the buses to San Diego, and the next bus to San Diego didn't leave till 1 o'clock in the afternoon. But if I wanted to hop on the bus to L.A. right now, I could catch that bus. And I thought, hey, if I get to LA, I get a little bit closer. And I missed the opportunity to split that six-pack with those guys. And I don't know if I was that depressed about that at the time. I don't know if I really gathered what the implications would have been if I had taken that first drink. But I didn't. And I got to LA and I got to San Diego in the middle of the night and I walked the streets of Golden Hills all night. And I guess I got woke up on the front porch of a recovery home. I kind of crashed there in the little entryway there, and they told me nobody would be there till like 8 or 9 o'clock, but they gave me some coffee, and they just told me, you know, we got to do our program, you got to stay out here. But when it opened, they welcomed me home, and they gave me my first start at recovery in a formalized way. And what happened was, is then I got really introduced at the 1 o'clock at 30th and Cedar. I got introduced to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where I got introduced to AA. I'd read the big book. I've been through the big book 150 times. I read all the stories. I read the foreword. I read all of it, right? And, you know, the foreword of the first edition, you know, you hear people say in AA, it's like, well, if you're not convinced, go out and drink. But even our big book doesn't tell us to do that until the 31st page. And it says in the foreword to the first edition that we hope these pages prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. Right? No further authentication meaning drinking. And so what I tell people, if you're really on the cusp, let's go through the process of the foreword to all the editions, the preface, and the first 31 pages. And if the big book gets to the point where they recommend you go drink, then have at it. But until that time, follow the process. And so what happened for me was, and people say I'm a little bit rigid, and I might be, but I'm on a life or death errand, right? I have a really awesome life today. I didn't have it such for many, many years, right? On the day my high school class graduated at Point Loma High, I was in San Quentin, and I thought I was cool. And I thought I had a prison ID card with my C number on it, and I'm looking at it, and I'm slamming it on the steel desk in a 6x6 cell in East Block in San Quentin, and I thought I was cool. And I thought the kids in my class were a bunch of lames. And that's delusional. And so that's a life or death errand. And if you're on a life or death errand like that, then there's no then you need to be rigid. And it says the book is meant to be suggestive. But if you take the suggestiveness of the book talks about precise, clear-cut directions, and it nails it for you. It doesn't talk about, you might want to do this. And it's when it said to pray, I prayed, and when it said to read, I read, and when it said to write, I wrote. Just like that. I did it in the order they said to do it. And I got blessed with good sponsorship. And we went, and I hear people tell me all the time, I'm stuck on the four step. And I say, you're stuck on the first step. Because there's no way to get stuck on the fourth step. If you're 100% convinced, the way I'm convinced, of dying a hopeless, helpless, shootout, drunk death with the San Diego Police Department, you're going to do anything. And it talks about the flimsy reed as being a loving hand of God in our big book. And it's... But the thing is it's like if you're drowning, are you going to ask questions when the life preserver comes? It's not that deep. And that's what we do here. That's what we do in AA. We ask questions. Like you're drowning and you ask questions. And so the thing is that you won't get stuck on any of the other steps. So I suggest if you are stuck on the fourth step, recommit yourself to the first step. Become 100% convinced. For me, unfortunately, it was drinking whiskey that made me convinced. So I don't recommend that. But go through the first 31 pages and become convinced. Hopefully no further authentication will become necessary. But I did that stuff and we read through the big book and I got to this part in the big book where it said, being convinced we were at step 3. And the big book doesn't spend any time giving you directions on how to take the first and second step. Whiskey does that. It gives you a lot of discussion about Bill's story, and there is a solution, and more about alcoholism, and it gives you a lot of experience, but it doesn't tell you how to take the first and second step. But when you get to page 60, it says, being convinced of these three pertinent ideas that we read in every meeting, A, B, and C, you are at step three. And that's where I was. I was at step three. The moment I walked into that recovery home, I was at step three. And what happened was, you know, step three isn't saying a prayer, it's making a decision, right? Hereafter, in this drama of life, we're going to decide to let God run the show and keep our mouth shut. That's a tall order. We all know that. But that's the decision. We make the decision. And then we affirm that decision with a prayer. And that's what I did. And then it says next, we launch out on a course of vigorous action, right? We write an inventory. It doesn't say wait 3 weeks. Next means now. It doesn't say take your time until you feel better. You're never going to feel better. Maybe even after you've taken the steps, you might not feel better. And so I did that. And then it broke it down. And I'm one of those guys that if I read the whole paragraph, I get confused. And so I just had to read a sentence. And it said we listed principles, personalities. And it has a period, right, with whom we were angry. Period. End of sentence. List them. Do that first. Finish that. Go to the next sentence. Finish that and go to the next sentence. And so in the end, I had this column type inventory that listed all the people I were mad at and all the reasons, the areas of my life that were affected and where I was to blame. And what the fourth step in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous does is it tricks you. And it tricks you into thinking that the first two columns, which are the truth, right? And the last two columns, which are a lie, get flipped. And it turns out that the first two columns end up being the lie and the last two columns are the truth. And it's the areas of your life and your part. And what happened in that process for me was that I learned that I could be 99% trouble-free because 99% of my problems were of my own making. That's what I learned from that process. It tricked me. And I also got some records cleared out and it put me in touch with a power greater than myself with which those 1% of the time that the problems aren't of my own making, I have a power to deal with that. And I did the fear inventory and I did the sex inventory and I asked those questions. The nine questions, there are nine questions in there. It says, when did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? What could I have done instead? All these questions, I answered each one with my relationship just the way it said to do in the big book. And I read that off. And I read it off to someone and you know, it turns out that that's not that big a deal. It's not that big a deal. I still have my first... I sometimes read it off to guys I sponsor because they get uncomfortable with that, having to do that. You know, when I got done with my fifth step, I'm automatically on the sixth step. It's just follow the numbers. And in the sixth step, you know, it says we review the first five proposals. And it talked about the cornerstone and the keystone and talked about cement way back in the forward to the first edition and then there is a solution. It talks about the cement. One of the powerful pieces of cement that binds us is this common peril that we've survived from. But that won't keep us together. The common solution will. And it uses terms like keystone, cornerstone, the arch to freedom, cement, mixing mortar without sand. And if you don't know any of these words, it's because you haven't read the book. And if you've read the book, you understand what I'm saying. And it asked me if I'd mixed mortar without sand, if the cement was proper, if the foundation was in place, which means I look at the first five proposals, had I been thorough? And I was able to answer yes. And it says to sit quietly for an hour at home. It doesn't say go up on top of Mount Palomar and burn your fourth step. It says go home quietly for an hour so you can be undistracted. For an hour, not 43 minutes, and not an hour and 43 minutes, and review the first five proposals. And I did that, literally, 1 hour, ready to go. I came out of that room, I was on step seven. And in step seven, six and seven are like, there's some stuff to read, and you got to ask God for some help, but there's not like this long, prolonged agony about it. You go through it, you're done. And the way you prove you did six and seven is you produce a piece of paper in step eight. And the way I've proved I've done the step prior is by producing the deliverable in the next step. In step eight, I have a deliverable. It's a list. In my case, it was everybody on my resentment list to start, where I owed amends to, and then some. And so I have a list of people that I have to make amends to. And then you go about doing it. And it says once we embark on this that we begin the world of 10, 11, and 12 immediately. So you start 9. You're not going to finish 9 overnight. None of us are going to finish 9, maybe never. But it doesn't mean we stay stuck on 9. It says once we commence this way of living, we go into the spiritual side of 10, 11, and 12. I'm paraphrasing. But that's what it says. And that's what happened for me. And I began my amends. And what happened was I got confronted on it because I thought I was going to be a little bit slick on how I did my amends. And someone said, well, what are you doing to pay? I couldn't go to college because I owed debts because I spent somebody else's money and I, you know, had some non-sufficient funds checks and some fraud cases. And so I couldn't get a student loan. Well, for me to go to school, which is something I desired, I had to clean that up. And I called this the Visa company, or the Visa card, and I told them, hey, I can give you $35 a month. And they're like, well, you owe us $3,000. And I'm like, yeah, but you're going to get $35 a month. That's what I can afford. And the lady argued with me. You know, she's like, well, we'll take you to court. And I'm like, I just got out of doing 15 years in prison. What the heck are you going to do to me? Right? You're going to take me to civil court? Whee! So, I mean, that's the situation. But I made my amends. I made the best deal I could. I started paying it off. The more I paid off, my wife and I, I thought I'd paid them all off. I get a bill for $982 for some dog I took to a vet back in 1981. I don't even remember. And it was a collection agency. And I'm like, I was all happy because I thought I'd paid them off. And I got another $985. And we're trying to buy a house. I think it was during the week we were closing, and I had to scramble around to get that money. And it's like, these are the things that happen. But the more I paid my amends, the better jobs I got. And when I look back on it, every time I upped the ante on paying my amends, I got a pay raise or I got a better job to pay more amends. And I drove a truck that had 410,000 miles on it, so I wasn't buying BMWs. And, you know, in the 10th step, the most awesome promise says that we've entered the world of the Spirit. And what I can tell you today is in the world of the Spirit, anything's possible. I know this for 100% certainty. I don't always act that way, but I know it for 100% certainty. And I struggled in my, what year is this now? 12, 2005, 6. I struggled in my teenage years because I had to go through a treatment, interferon. And it made me really, so they said, it could make you suicidal. And in those rare cases of 1% of the population, it might make you homicidal. I'm that rare case. And so I have never been suicidal, and I've always been homicidal. And I was about a year and a half. My wife corrected me today on the drive down. It was 18 months. I think she's exaggerating slightly. But to any extent, I was a miserable son of a gun for 18 months. And I was mad. And I was mad at all of you. And I struggled in those teenage years of being sober, and I distanced myself from you, and I distanced myself from others, and I fortunately did not distance myself from God. You know, and that was the saving grace. And you know, the thing is that I can't even begin to tell you how cool that is, because I mean, I really acted godless, and I couldn't care less about you or anything else. And I would just do some of the most insane things in my alcoholism, both drunk and dry. I mean, even separated from booze for a bit, I would do some incredibly tragic things to people. I had no regard for human life whatsoever. I didn't care. And the thing is that if I sat here and told you today what I like do for a living, and where I live, and what hobbies I have, and what I do to occupy myself, what you would say is that guy's had too much to drink, and don't listen to a word he says because he's full of it. That's what you'd say. I guarantee it. Because I'd say the same thing. I know. And, you know, in the 12th step it says, you know, AA is a tiny little pond. And it's a big tiny pond. There's a lot of alcoholics that are sober. But we're about 10% of the world. We're a tiny, tiny, tiny pond. And I've challenged myself, I try to challenge myself to do what it says and to do this in all my affairs. And in my work life, I act like this to the best of my ability. I'm not that way every day, trust me. But I treat my employees with the way I'd want to be treated in AA. I try not to have, you know, like if someone has a disagreement with me I try to be open-minded to the fact that they might have a good idea. I try not to let personal disdain for somebody prevent me from hiring them if they're the person for the job. And I have a lot of people like that, that I may not personally agree with, but are part of the staff and a contributing part of the staff because of AA. And to practice these principles in all our affairs, I had this really cool opportunity when I first got sober, when I was newly sober and newly free, to work with juvenile delinquents and juveniles in an H&I setting. And I loved it, and I thrived in it. But it, you know, as anything with funding required by the county gets, it got pulled from me. And one thing I learned is that, you know, volunteer work's everywhere. It's not just in AA. It's everywhere. And we can be part of our communities, and we can be part of our jobs, and we can be part of all kinds of big things outside of AA, as long as we don't forget that. And practicing these principles in all of our affairs, when we enter the world of the Spirit, anything's possible. And when we say service, it's not picking up ashtrays. It's not doing coffee. Service means to be of maximum service to God and your fellows. And it doesn't have anything about AA in there. I'm not suggesting you don't do stuff in AA. But God and your fellows is everyone. And we can act one way here and act completely different outside. And that's not correct if it's not acting correct out there. And so, for me, it's been this last few years of really trying to bring what I learned here from you people. I learned it from you out into the rest of my world. And some days I'm good at it and some days I'm not so good at it. And anyways, I want to thank you for allowing me to speak here tonight. And thanks for asking me. And God bless.